You ready?
We're ready to resume, please. We'll now move to topic number three. I'll read topic number three. It is Task Force Recommendation 2C. LSC should re-examine the rule as currently interpreted that mandates adherence to LSC grantee case handling requirements, including that matters be accepted as grantee cases in order for programs in order to count for PAI requirements. We have five panelists who've asked to be heard on that, everyone except David Udell. And we will start with John Whitfield.
John Whitfield with Blue Ridge Legal Services, speaking on behalf of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association. We think absolutely that LSC should re-examine this rule that mandates adherence to the CSR handbook for matters to be accepted as to be counted towards PAI requirements. As I alluded to earlier, LSC currently allows grantees to do cases and also other services, or used to be called other matters. And other matters include such things as community legal education, other forms of providing legal information to our clients or groups. And those are not counted as cases, but they are absolutely legitimate activities with LSC funds. By the same token, it ought to hold true for PAI activities as well. There's nothing that should mandate that a PAI activity has to be a case. There are lots of ways of involving the private bar, the legal profession as volunteers, in ways that can assist our clients with their legal problems without that activity necessarily being a case. There have been instances where there are advice clinics that private firms or private bars or private attorneys are operating in a situation either in a courthouse or elsewise where they can't be screened conveniently. Yet it's providing an immense service to our client population. And if there's a way we can leverage that and cause those activities to happen, I think that's a good thing, and LSC ought to encourage it, not impede it. Yes, it's true that we won't know necessarily that every person assisted that way would be an eligible client. But I think the test ought to be if the activity is designed and targeted to benefit the client base who is eligible, then if an incidentally non-eligible person is also benefited, then that should not mean that it's an ineligible activity. Give you an example. Right now, LSC, through its TIG grants, in every state has LSC grantees posting legal information on the internet, telling people about all kind of information about legal problems affecting our client population. Your rights as a tenant, how to avoid eviction, what to do if the landlord's trying to evict you, the eviction process. Now, certainly lots of our clients benefit from that. We have no way of knowing if a landlord also doesn't read that and says, oh, this is how it's done, and that's not an intended beneficiary, and he's certainly not an eligible client. But it's still, I believe, a permissible LSC activity. Now, you could say, well, let's do another example. You on one extreme, you'd post information on how to file and waive your filing fees due to your poverty. By definition, only going to low-income people. Seems like that would be a safe one. On the other hand, the other extreme would be your rights as an undocumented alien. That would probably fall outside the pale pretty easily. So the subject matter sort of defines whether it's something that within the scope of helping our clients, designed to help our client base or not, eligible clients. Now, if you were concerned that website, that someone who's not eligible, that maybe someone who's not documented might open that website and read information there, you could say, well, in that case, we want you to screen everybody that uses that website. and therefore you want to put a password on that website. And anybody who wants to use the access to that website has to call your office, go through intake, be screened, do the citizen attestation, and then you give them the password, and then they can go to the website and access that legal information you've posted there. It's doable, but you would completely defeat the purpose of having those websites, which is to easily, conveniently distribute information to as many people as you can, as easily and effectively and as possible. You would defeat that by putting that password on there. By analogy, the same thing would hold true in PAI activities. By requiring any PAI activity to go through the CSR handbook, you're basically saying we want a password on the website. When you have all these PAI activity attorneys, firms, bar associations who want to help our clients, who are engaging in activities that are designed to help our client population, and we want to support that and want to encourage that, and I think you do too. So don't require the password on the website by requiring that every person who benefits from it be screened and found eligible. If incidentally once someone is not found, is not eligible, don't let that kill the program. Thank you.
Thank you. Patricia?
Thank you. This remains the appropriate time to reexamine case handling requirements as they apply to the private attorney involvement rule, and to determine which of those requirements are really the essentials. And I recognize that alienage is probably at the top of the list. It may even exceed the income qualification. And I think it's also probably one of the most difficult things to deal with. And yet I would tell you that activities that screen and refer, we're doing it in-house. We're talking to, and before we get all the screening done, people may have actually learned something about the process of unemployment compensation claims or how to file a small claims action, because we're trying to screen them to find out if they're even appropriate callers, much less eligible callers. But providing support to the activities that do serve people who are not screened. And that's been a lot of my conversation today, is talking about supporting those activities, not providing the action, not providing the screening, but supporting those who do screen, so that when we invest money in training manuals and we're the primary educator in our state for poverty law issues, that we aren't just providing it to the volunteer lawyers who are going to handle our eligible clients who have been screened according to our standards. But we also want to partner up in the legal services community so that the lawyers who, from the AIDS Resource Center and the domestic abuse programs, also have an opportunity to take advantage of that training. So, again, our program has, you know, kind of settled it out for what we do with our clients. I describe in my written submission the clinics that we use, not just to screen, and we've already found people eligible before they come into our office, but our volunteers want us to kind of develop the case to some extent. We use volunteer lawyers to do that. But not all of these programs are going to invest that kind of effort. They're going to screen. They're going to refer. We want them making the best decisions about that. We want to be able to support them and count that toward our PAI investment in growing pro bono. Let me see if there's some other points that I want to hit that are not in my writing. And I think I've addressed most of that. Do you intend to have a separate discussion of 2001, or would you like me to comment on that now?
You can comment on that now.
Okay.
Thank you.
The effect of that ruling actually had a chilling effect on two very important projects that we had spent some years working on. My predecessor, so going back more than 10 years ago, had been very involved in Milwaukee County in establishing the first self-help clinic. We brought in the child support agency. We brought in the clerk of court. We got the judges online. And there was no interest on the part of anybody other than us in screening these people for income or whether they were citizens or not. But we were definitely the lead in getting this project off the ground. We continued to provide support services, training, scheduling, and the infrastructure for a project like that. And many of our lawyers spent their non-work time working in that noontime clinic. And the effect of this ruling was to stop that work. Fortunately for the community, somebody else was able to step in. The Milwaukee Bar Association stepped in. But it took them quite a while. It took a couple of years for them to shake it out and get it operating the way they have it now. In another area, in northwestern Wisconsin, actually it's north central, but we all think, in Milwaukee, we think of it as north, La Crosse area, our La Crosse service area. There's a veterans home in the neighboring county, and we'd been very involved in going to the homeless center that was established near the VA hospital. We had several volunteer lawyers who were vets who were very interested in that. And so they wanted to take on responsibility for that. But they didn't want to be screening people. They didn't want to have to disqualify them or say, I can't serve you because they're standing here. They've come in for that Wednesday afternoon or that Thursday clinic. We don't know exactly where they'd come from, but they were all homeless. And it put a chilling effect on that clinic where they had to kind of slow down and reevaluate where we were. Ultimately, it meant that we now sent a staff member to drive about 45 minutes so that she could do the screening and the volunteer lawyer could do the work. He continued to counsel the clients who didn't qualify for our services, but we didn't consider them cases. We didn't record his work that he did, but he wasn't going to turn anybody away. So, I mean, we found a way to keep that one going, and it's still going. We've had a succession of volunteer lawyers, and that's a good thing, actually. But the effect of the decision is to pull us out or to take a step back from some of these activities that are important in our community, and it probably has a greater impact in the communities where there are fewer opportunities for people to access assistance. The smaller communities, the more rural communities, where the only activity may be the one sponsored by the Bar Association, where they are not willing to screen people. They may collect data on their income, very interesting phenomena, but it's done in ranges generally. But they don't want to say no to anybody because they their income is too high. The alienage issue is another one altogether. We certainly continue to screen for that. We understand the importance of that when this rule was written. But that's another one of those things about which I think that was 30 years ago. And there are different issues now about alienage than there were 30 years ago. Hopefully the issues can, I mean, I'm not asking you to take this one on. I think it's a really big one, but it's certainly something that bears more thought. Thank you.
Mark O'Brien.
Thanks. So again, I think this is one of those places where, you know, it's worth sort of stopping for a moment and reflecting on what LSC's overall goals are. And I think that LSC's goal of sort of full access, we need to think about how do we encourage grantees to structure programs and incentivize them to be delivering services in contexts where they can best support their communities' goals of full access to justice for the communities that they're serving. And that can mean participation in, you know, multi-organizational clinics where or even clinics by legal services organizations with bar associations where volunteers are providing brief advice and service or maybe going to take cases on. I see the value in maintaining a distinction about cases that are going to be recognized as – services are going to be recognized as full cases for legal LSE grantees to make sure that those meet all the requirements. But again, would agree with the comments of the previous panelists that it doesn't make a lot of sense to try and distinguish between the support provided for clinics in which some of the cases may to try and distinguish which of the cases and what amount of our support went towards the cases that were eligible as full cases within, you know, the CSR and which of the services provided by our volunteers and our support and oversight and training of those people went into the services that they provide that wouldn't meet the CSR guidelines. I made a couple of calls to programs that we work with in different parts of the country over the last week, asking them about kind of the outline that I had prepared. And I talked to, you know, a very senior person at one of the programs in New York who was remembering in the immediate aftermath of Sandy going out and doing clinics and how demoralizing it was for their staff as there were people queued up in lines in really desperate situations to have to sit there and put them through a screening, that it almost seemed cruel at some point to have to go through all of the screening before they were able to offer people immediate assistance that they were seeking. And I also spoke to someone from one of the Oklahoma programs who was talking about how in the aftermath of the tornadoes there, how sort of reassuring it was to see that all of the investments that LSC has made in the capacity of their program and others to use technology and to make online systems available and training and support materials available to volunteers, you know, have sort of become the spine on which not only their own program was able to mount its legal relief efforts in the aftermath of the tornadoes, but the Bar Association and others were able to leverage that. And, you know, that was a great thing. And that thinking about how do we incentivize programs to think as broadly as possible in their support activities for the efforts of the private bar and partnering legal aid organizations that are not necessarily LSE programs, while maintaining sort of strict adherence to the regulations for the cases that they're handling as full cases for their organizations, that we should be promoting the sort of more expansive activities of grantees.
Jennifer Van Dolman on behalf of NABPRO. Sort of very briefly, NABPRO, our recommendation is that LSC would adopt this recommendation as the others as well. But there's much stronger support for this recommendation from our members than the other two recommendations. Further, our members express less concern about any types of conditions and express that if there must be conditions that you'd consider the other conditions we discussed in the past. But I think for the most part, NABPRO members really feel that this ought to go forward as it's been recommended. In particular, I would talk about this from the client's perspective. What we're really talking about for the most part, are outreach type of situations. And I think of this from a snowy Akron winter where a client comes in and we've only been able to give them the opportunity to come to a clinic because there's no other service that's available to them in the community. In fact, legal aid is usually the last door available to anybody who is of limited means. So they come to the legal clinic trudging through the snow, maybe bringing two or three children and whatever else they need to bring in order to accommodate our schedule to come to our outreach clinic. And what they're faced with is our eligibility standards. And they then fill out the form, and maybe they're eligible and maybe they're not, but sometimes they're not. And then I look at that from the volunteer attorney's perspective, because they're sitting there watching us do this, and they see a woman come in with her three children and who's busy and who has accommodated her schedule to meet our schedules. And then they are asked, we have to turn them away, and the volunteer attorney wonders why. Because we're out there to serve the community, and their intent as a private attorney is to come out and serve the community, to do pro bono, and maybe they're marginally over income, maybe they're not. The vast majority of the people who come to our outreach clinics are, in fact, eligible for our services, regardless of whether we would screen them or we wouldn't screen them. The vast majority are. And it's difficult for volunteer attorneys in those situations to look at that client and see them walk out the door. And I think that's something that LSD should consider, not only from the client's perspective, but also from the volunteer attorney's perspective. If we are trying to build pro bono, this is not the way to do it. The volunteer attorneys, there are a couple who will say, are you sure this person's eligible? I mean, there's those that will question when they think in their gut, maybe this isn't the client who really needs service. So I want to admit fully that there have been those volunteers who have done that when somebody's substantially over income. But the majority of volunteers would have said, I'm here. I accommodated my schedule. The client did the same. Let me serve that client. And so for those reasons, and also the reasons of offering a variety of opportunities for clients and the minimal impact of this type of a regulation on people who would be over income, I would ask that LSC would adopt this recommendation as it stated.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Melissa Skilder from Ohio State Legal Services Association, and we are the organization at issue in Advisory Opinion 2008-1001. And so this is, of course, a very important issue to us. It's really the reason that I'm here today. I wanted to give you a little background about who we are and how we got here. We've got 30 rural counties with no major cities that probably any of you would have heard of before. No major firms. Most of our people are, or most of the attorneys in our areas are solo practitioners. A large firm to me is about 10 attorneys, and most of our counties don't have firms of that size. Over the last few years, we have lost about a third of our staff attorneys, and so that's been due to attrition. With budget cuts as they are, we're not filling positions. We've been able to avoid layoffs of attorneys at this point, but that is under discussion right now. And so at this point, we're trying to do even more than we've done with even less than we've had. I personally was a staff attorney in our Zanesville office. I'm married to a former staff attorney from our Zanesville office. I've worked in these clinics personally, and I work side by side with the attorneys that volunteer there, so I feel like I know our people in our clinics quite well. When the PAI regulations came into effect, we had a hard time getting a PAI program going up and running in our area. To be honest, when we started as a legal aid program, there was resistance to our being in existence, even at that level, and even more to us going out and trying to get people to aid in our efforts. Early on, John McKay, former LSC board president, came in to one of our towns, Chillicothe, to try to help us recruit, and we were thrilled at the effort, although we didn't see a lot of return from that. What we've seen on our in our experience is the personal contacts and our relationships that we've been able to build over the years. The clinics that we run were our first success with PAI. They were what really resonated with people. They the attorneys in our areas, they're interested in helping their communities. As Jen said, they may not want to help legal aid. They may see us as a competitor. They may see us as an adversary. But they do, regardless of their other beliefs, look out into the need in their community and want to serve that. We have, over the years, very much tried to build the perception and the fact in our community that these are collaborations, that these are not a legal aid project. They're almost across the board a joint project between the local bar association and between our organization. And so we don't have 100% control over these clinics because they're not 100% owned by us. And that, I think, is a success of the clinic. That's why attorneys show up for them. They're willing to help their bar. They're willing to help their community. They may or may not help legal aid, but that's not what they see themselves doing. We have resisted the full screening that LSC has required of us for several reasons. Like I said, the more control we exert over the operation of these clinics, the more they become our clinic, and the less, in some of our places, the less they'll be supported by the people that volunteer there. We will lose volunteers, both by the additional hassle factor of additional screening and also of the beginning to assert what they would deem to be unnecessary control over what's really a community project. It would be an additional dedication of time to do that in a time when we've got less time, we've got less staff to do it. One of the questions that was raised early on was about the investment made into PAI versus the return that you're getting on that. The additional screening on a clinic raises the investment on the time that we have to spend operating them, while at the same time limiting the return that we get on that. We will see fewer clinic participants if we screen everyone at a full LSC screening level. That's because we'd either have to do it ahead of time, which will mean there are more people that don't get registered for it, or there's simply going to be more time that we invest in doing that. And there's already going to be clinics where people show up, wait for their time to get screened, and sometimes people stay and sometimes people don't. With a low-income community, sometimes you have to move swiftly and efficiently to make sure that you can fit in the window that they've got to try to deal with their problems. Furthermore, the way we've been conducting our clinics, we don't consider them to be our clients. And so as a community project, we have been able to send our conflict people there, which is considered by us and by our communities to be a true asset to the clinics. Like I said, we're rural southeastern Ohio, and there is no bar referral program operating in any of our 30 counties. There isn't another legal aid-like project operating in any of our counties. If we have screened somebody and admitted them as a client in the clinic, and we're conflicted out from helping the adverse party in another situation, there's nowhere else for that person to go. And we see that as probably our largest concern with fully meeting the LSC regs as they're currently being interpreted. We believe it's an odd result that the greater success that we have in making a program be a collaborative community project, and the more difficult it is to count it as a PAI project. I give, for example, the Fairfield County Clinic, which operates in Lancaster, Ohio. It's very successful. It's loved by the participants that get their legal advice there, by the attorneys that volunteer, the people on the bench that refer local litigants there. We were even honored by a local legislature by a proclamation in our state General Assembly. The way it works right now is we have a volunteer doing a limited financial screening, and then we have another volunteer doing the recruiting. Legal aid has a staff person there at the clinic to sort of help make things operate smoothly, answer questions, whether it be about the limited screening or about an area of law that the volunteer doesn't know anything about, and to provide support. And then also, if we've got too many clients and not enough volunteers, we'll do a full screening and have a staff person try to help control the flow of clinic participants. But it operates very well. And to my knowledge, no one has questioned the way that we operate as far as in regard to the quality of the product that we provide to our clients. However, where we stand right now with regard to the LSC regs is we've got a choice to make whether we're going to step up and tell our community partners, I'm sorry, you have to change the way you're doing this. You have to change something that you like to something that you don't like as well. We can limit the amount of assistance that clients get there. We can say, I'm sorry, you can only get legal information. You can do everything the same, and we can give you less help, and then that does count as a PAI activity. Or, you know, we could pull out of the clinic altogether and say, we appreciate this project so much that we're not going to hurt it to meet our PAI regs. And none of those options seems like a good one to me. We would not do any of those. We would not operate in that way if it weren't for the LSC regs. And I think it's a real detriment to have a regulation that interferes with our ability to help our clients and to work with our community partners in a way that doesn't have a benefit for the clients. And that's truly what is the most upsetting for me. One of the questions that's been posed is how LSC would know that this is a project that is geared towards helping the poor. In my submission, I suggested that you might look to the group representation regulations, where you're looking at whether it's an organization that's primary purpose is to serve the income eligible client population. I think that's a useful rubric. We've also suggested that you look at the details of the clinic. For example, our clinics are taking place in churches in our southeastern Ohio neighborhoods, and it's regarded by the bar as being a low-income service. I can tell you when we went out into the communities and we said, we'd like to do these pro bono clinics and we'd like for you to meet with our clients, there was uproar. You're going to steal our clients. You're going to take money out of our pocket. You're going to be seeing people that don't really qualify. Some of those same people that were completely against the clinics are routine, regular volunteers now, and that does not happen if our volunteers think that we're seeing clients that can actually afford an attorney. And in our communities, these are solo practitioners who are representing the low to middle income people in their communities. We're not pulling from Jones Day or something where there really is no competition between the clinics and the attorneys. There's true competition there, and they're supported by those same people that had those concerns. I think if you look at the details of the way the projects are crafted, you'll be able to find a way to determine that our primary purpose is to serve income eligible people, and that's what we're doing. There's a difference between, you know, walking out the door here into Georgetown and perhaps setting up a legal clinic, and that, or, you know, in our situation, we're in a small town in rural Ohio in a church where people are really only turning if it's the only option that they've got. So, I appreciate the effort that you're taking to improve these regulations, and I hope that we'll be able to help you in that process. Thank you.
Thank you. We don't have any questions on the webinar at this point. Do the board members participating have any questions? Charles.
Well, one of the things that has come up with regard to this, and your comments also raised it inferentially, has to do with the idea of there's full LSC screening, right, which we're familiar with it, and then there's no screening, which is the website model, right? And so then you talked about limited screening that you were doing, and so I'm wondering. There's obviously still many complications with regard to the issue of accepting it as a client case and all of that. Whether there is a role for limited screening, such that you're providing an evidentiary basis. You know, you talked about an intent to serve the poor, and there's evidence about your intent. You talked about the design. You're designing it for people who would be the kind of people who would be eligible for programs. But then there's also the issue of effect. Is your intent being carried out? Is there some kind of evidentiary basis that you can develop from a standpoint of limited screening that can show that that intent is in fact being carried out? And that, and so I was thinking, well, I'm not sure what sort of exactly limited screening means in that context. I think there's a lot of different things, but it seems to me it would be useful in some ways to have, are you a citizen?
Yes.
Are you, do you have, you know, below a certain threshold? Yes. Now that's, that doesn't obviously satisfy true LSC eligibility, since some people who are not citizens are eligible and some income can vary and assets and so forth and all of that can change. But if you ask those two questions and you know that about the people at the clinic, is that, would that be too onerous for them, or how would that balance out? How would that balance work with something like that?
I have a response to that. It's Melissa Skilleter again. That's almost exactly what we're doing, and I don't believe that that's too onerous. The second part of that question that you didn't raise is what happens when there are people there that are over the regular LSC income limits. I think that the first part with the level of screening comes into play in two parts, the check boxes that aren't the full screening. But like I said, we also have volunteers doing that screening in some places, and we have less quality assurances when we do it that way. I think that it's reliable and it's a reasonable thing to do, but it's a different thing for me to say I can guarantee if I have my professional screener here than if I have a volunteer. And so that's one of the levels of scrutiny that I would put a pin in. Then what I would also suggest is that we would be able to see some people who would be over the income as long as it was predominantly to serve people who were with that reduced screening that were predominantly eligible, so that it addresses the issue of people who, like Jen said, have trudged through the snow or are particularly sympathetic, or for whatever reason the volunteers there on the ground have determined that it's within the purpose of the clinic to help serve that person. So I would say that there should be some flexibility there in seeing some people who are over the income limits, as well as the sort of reduced scrutiny and getting the questions answered themselves.
John Whitfield also responding, and this is not for NLEDA, but my own personal views, I guess. I find the idea interesting. If it were approached as one approach that could be used, so it was a sampling or an informal survey occasionally of the people who attended, and it was simple, like, are you low income, are you a citizen, or are you documented? Something very simple, something that they could complete in 30 seconds at the end of the session, so that it would not interfere with their participation. And that, you know, if you just did that maybe occasionally, and then if you found that the responses were predominantly eligible clients or not ineligible, then that would allow that to be counted as a permissible PAI service, not a PAI case. I think that would be an approach.
Board Chair John Levy has a question. John?
Am I unmuted?
Yes, you are.
I didn't have so much a question, but I figured that you were nearing the end, and I just wanted to say I've been listening. I think this has been a terrific afternoon, and I want to thank everybody for their time and their thoughtfulness. And then for our management, really, are we able to pilot anything going forward in response to either to any of these three issues, and see how they work, or do we have to actually make the change and then see how we go from there?
I think that's something we can consider and discuss. The pilot approach.
And finally, and it's not really relevant to the three things. I can't tell you how many people come up to me and say, why don't you, if you're going to change the rule, change the name too. A private attorney involvement. And I don't know what our panelists think about that, but apparently it seems to engender some confusion. I don't know if it does for them or for others, but I don't know what we would replace it with. But so I know that's off track.
Sounds like a focus group waiting to happen.
Virginia Martin has a question or a comment.
Yes, I do. Thank you. This is Virginia Martin. I wanted to talk about the last part of Topic 3, including that matters be accepted as grantee cases in order for programs to count toward PAI requirements. And again, the comments that I have are personal ones involving my own program. We are a sub-grantee of LSC funds. When we do the intake screening for a case, find out that on our own, find out that the person is eligible, refer it, do all of that work, we can only count that case as toward our PAI commitment or requirement if that case, the entire case and client become, you know, a case and client of the LSC grantee. It creates burdens for the LSC grantee. It creates conflicts. We also have to secure permission from the clients that we can disclose their confidential information to the LSC grantee. So I just wanted to comment on that. It would seem to me that if a sub-grantee is adhering to all of the case handling requirements, that couldn't we count those cases toward our PAI requirement without those cases having to be become cases of the LSC grantee?
Thank you. Board member Julie Riskin has a question or a comment. Julie?
I just wanted to thank the panelists. This has been both your verbal comments and what you wrote has been really, really helpful and incredible, and also echo what John said to the staff, that this has been a really instructive and useful and terrific webinar. So I just wanted to thank everyone.
Thank you, Julie. Ken Pinocchi has a question or a comment.
I just want to comment on the modified screening. We do that on both our internet advice site, which we're not allowed to report on, and our clinical program in our only pseudo-large city, Traverse City. And what we do is we do not collect name and address. All the rest of the screening goes forward per LSC regulations. But by not collecting name and address, we are preventing ourselves from becoming conflicted for our priority cases. And that's an example of a modified screening that could be allowed, and it has both the same purpose of making sure that the LSC regulations are complied with, but yet making sure that programs, especially in rural areas where there is no other resource, have the ability to protect their high priority caseloads. Right now, none of this, the work that we do in this area, is reported, and it does have a chilling effect, especially on our online system, which could have been greatly expanded, but we have been prevented from doing so because of these kind of restrictions. And I remind everybody that, you know, the worst case scenario on these programs is that a client who may not be eligible gets advice from a private attorney. We're not providing the resources for that advice. We're not giving that advice. It's some private attorney. So it only makes sense since the program's involvement in this advice is so much less that the screening requirement be somewhat less also. Thank you.
Mark, did you have a comment?
Yeah, it's Mark O'Brien. Just wanted to make a brief comment that, you know, I think it's worth sort of distinguishing between the kinds of surveying and data collection that we do for eligibility purposes and the kind of screening and data collection that we do for program effectiveness evaluation purposes. And I think that, you know, the trick for LSC in some ways is to figure out how to sort of, you know, incentivize programs to do the latter. You know, I don't actually think that I don't think that some of the screening that we've been talking about should be necessarily a bar to service, but I think that we shouldn't, the program should be encouraged to collect information so that they can assess over time, well, are we serving, you know, we're doing this because we're intending to serve low-income community members. Do we know after a period of time that we're accomplishing that or not? And we may stop or modify the service, not because it fits with a regulation or not, but because, in fact, maybe we need to find a different way to reach that group of clients. And I think that LSC is at a point, again, you know, where it has made a great commitment to expanding access and placing LSC's programs in partnership with other justice partners in their communities to find the most effective methods to accomplish that goal. And we have to be careful about creating rules that would undermine the program's abilities to do just that.
Are there any other questions or comments?
I have a suggestion for a new name. Involvement of the legal profession.
ILP?
I have one
question. Yes.
I just, as a final comment, because I know we're coming to the end, I again want to thank LSC for taking the time to think about and really delve into these issues because it is so important. I've heard from many members of NABPRO that because many people have been around a lot longer than I have, that they were there back in the day, as they say, and where pro bono wasn't supported and where the mandate was such a controversial thing within the program, and it still is in some programs, and some programs still struggle. But the fact that LSC is taking a critical look at this and supporting pro bono and considering these recommendations as well as the remainder of the task force report, those blueprints, again, is such an important thing to promote pro bono. The private attorneys who work with our programs are critical, I think, to the success of legal aid programs and being able to deliver legal services to the poor. They're an important partner, and I think they recognize that more than ever, and LSC's role in providing leadership has been really critical in helping them be empowered to feel that they have a part of the responsibility to serve the poor. It's not just the legal aid programs. So the role that you have taken is really important, and in particular, I heard Mr. Sandman talk about going to Congress a couple times, and that conversation or the things that I heard when he was talking about that were so important, I think, for legal aid programs to understand how the dollars are so competitive at Congress. And I think legal aid programs stand behind Legal Services Corporation and want to do our best to show a good face. And I think pro bono is a place where our programs can shine in Congress because we involve the private bar. We involve the public sector or the private sector as well as the public sector. And I am grateful that you're allowing pro bono to shine selfishly because I love pro bono and also selflessly because I think our clients so greatly need this. And I think
And I'm grateful. That's mostly my point. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all of our panel members for their very thoughtful written comments and for your equally thoughtful oral comments today. It's been very helpful to our deliberations. I'd also like to thank Mark Friedman and the Office of Legal Affairs for their work in organizing and facilitating this workshop.
Thank you. And I will now, with the thanks, my own personal thanks and the thanks of the Operations and Regulations Committee, bring this rulemaking workshop to a close. Thank you all.